This is Nachyomi, Sefer Shemuel Bet, chapter 13. This chapter details the famous and very troubling incident known as the story of Amnon and Tamar. Amnon is the firstborn son of David and has fallen madly and crazily in love with Tamar, who is described as his very beautiful sister from another mother that would make her his half-sister. We're going to address the details of this at the end of the summary, exactly what her relationship to him was. In any case, he doesn't feel comfortable approaching her in any romantic way, but he's almost paralyzed with his sorrow over the situation and his obsession with her. His friend and cousin, Yonadav, advises him to feign being ill and request that Tamar personally tend to him, preparing and serving him food. This will give him the opportunity to interact with her privately and maybe develop some connection with her. It seems like Yonadav is advising him to try to form a real relationship with Tamar. This suggestion meets with Amnon's approval. He pretends to be sick and asks for Tamar to come and prepare some kind of pancakes for him and to feed him on his sickbed. King David sends Tamar to fulfill the request of Amnon. She arrives, kneads the dough in front of him, prepares the cakes there. When they're ready, Amnon refuses to eat. He says that he wants everybody to leave. He then asks for Tamar to bring the food into his bedroom and to serve it to him on his bed. When she draws close to him to offer him the pancakes, he grabs hold of her and tries to force himself onto her. She resists and urges him not to do this despicable thing, but to speak to the king instead about the possibility of marrying her legally and appropriately, not to assault her and bring shame upon her and upon himself. Amnon doesn't listen, and he does rape Tamar. As soon as the act is completed, Amnon's emotions undergo a complete reversal. He feels nothing but hatred and revulsion for Tamar. And despite her tearful objections and begging him not to do so, he casts her out of his chamber, saying, "I want this woman out of here," not even referring to her by name. So he adds insult to injury, literally. Tamar was wearing the multicolored garment, the coat of many colors that the maiden daughters of the king typically wore. She tore her garment, put ashes on her head, as a sign of mourning, and went on her way weeping. Avshalom, her brother, another son of David, immediately surmises what has happened. When she confirms his suspicions that Amnon has assaulted her, he cautions her to keep it a secret to protect the honor of the family. David hears all that's transpired, but he is powerless to take any action against Amnon at this time. 2 years later, Avshalom is planning a shearing party for his flocks near the land of Ephraim, and he invites the entire royal family to attend. David turns down the invitation. He doesn't want to leave the palace unattended and unoccupied, but Avshalom therefore asks if Amnon, the son of David, can represent him at the party. Although David is a little bit surprised that Avshalom, who hates Amnon and doesn't speak with him, would want him to attend his party, he grants the request. Meanwhile, Avshalom prepares his servants to ambush Amnon when he arrives and to kill him, which they do. Word initially comes to David that all of his sons were killed, and he responds by beginning to mourn their deaths. However, eventually a messenger clarifies that only Amnon has been killed. Avshalom flees to Geshur to live with his grandparents, apparently, for about 3 years. His mother was the daughter of the king of Geshur. So this was going back to his roots on his maternal side. As time passes, David is comforted for the loss of Amnon, but he pines for Avshalom, who has forsaken him, essentially, has cut ties with his father at this point. So understanding the story, you know, these deeply troubling developments are clearly the beginning of the punishments that were foretold that they would come upon David when Natan HaNavi told him that as a result of his sin with Bathsheba, he would always have the sword in his home, meaning violence would prevail. And now we see also sexual immorality taking place right under the nose of David. But there's another interesting, really fascinating trend and sort of chain of parallels between the story of Amnon and Tamar and the story of Yosef, which is really remarkable. And a careful reader, especially somebody who's fluent in reading the book of Bereshit and would notice the nuances of the language in the book of Bereshit, will notice that there are phrases literally lifted from the book of Bereshit found in this story. Most obviously, to the reader, the coat of many colors, Ketonet Pasim, worn by Tamar in the story, is reminiscent of the one worn by Yosef. It's called the same word in the Torah, Ketonet Pasim. This is the only other place we find a Ketonet Pasim in the Torah, in the Tanakh. In our story, we have a stalker who creates a situation where he's alone with the object of his affection, just like Potiphar's wife invested a lot of effort in getting Yosef alone with her so she could take advantage of him. So we have similarities there. The stories of Amnon and Tamar and of Yosef both involve family drama of a very serious nature. In one case, brother murders brother, Avshalom kills Amnon, and the other, the brothers contemplate and almost kill Yosef. In both stories, the son is eventually estranged or separated from his father for a significant period of time, and they eventually reunite. In this case, it is Avshalom. In the case of the story of Yosef, it's Yosef and Yaakov. In both stories, the father sends his child or children right into the clutches of the one who wishes to harm them, because David sends Tamar to take care of Amnon, and then again sends Amnon to Avshalom, where he ends up being killed. Yaakov sends Yosef to his brothers. Moreover, there are two phrases that appear in the story of Amnon and Tamar that are strikingly evocative of the story of Yosef. One is Amnon's command, Hotziu chol ish me'alai, take every man out of my presence, which are the exact words Yosef uses before revealing his identity to his brothers in Egypt. The other is, he mourned over his son all the days, to describe David's reaction to the loss of either Amnon or Avshalom. It's not exactly clear which son is being referred to, which itself is reminiscent of the description of Yaakov that it tells us in the Torah, after he believed Yosef had died, he mourned over his son many days. We cannot escape the conclusion that these parallels are deliberate. Why are these two stories linked? Now, I believe the text really means to highlight the thematic commonalities between the narratives of Amnon and Tamar and Yosef, and that the commonalities can help us grasp a deeper message in the stories. Now, while he doesn't talk about the specific clues that we're mentioning here in the text, the Ralbag does identify one of the main ideas in the story as being that David placed his sons in positions of power, even from an early age. The Ralbag comments that this was an error on David's part. This led to a lot of problems, because he groomed them, as it were, to follow in his footsteps and continue his legacy, and he granted them a lot of influence, but they were not fully prepared to handle it. It was too early for them to be given that much power, that much influence, such a significant role. Now, the Ralbag doesn't connect this to the story of Yosef, and he doesn't talk about the textual parallels between the stories, but I think that this idea that he points out as one of the lessons you learn from David in this case can actually help us, if we take it a little bit further and apply it, can help us understand how the two stories are connected. How so? Well, in the story of David, so we know that after receiving the rebuke from Nathan over the sin with Bathsheba, David recedes to the background and begins to play a more passive and peripheral role in the kingdom. He was really devastated by the prophecy of Nathan. He was no longer as motivated or ambitious as he had once been. He was always wary, expecting the consequences he knew were going to be visited upon him. David's removal of himself from the scene allowed his children to play an even more active role in the affairs of state and in palace politics, as the Ralbag says, which wasn't such a good thing, and it led to the intrigue we read about in this chapter and in chapters to come. The story of Yaakov and Yosef exemplifies the same problem. The first verse of Parashat Vayeshev tells us that Yaakov settled in the land of Canaan, implying, as the rabbis explain, that he figured that his struggles, trials, and tribulations were over and that he could basically retire and focus on passing the baton of leadership to the next generation, specifically to Yosef. The rabbis say that it was precisely this decision on Yaakov's part that created and exacerbated the internal strife in the family and that nearly caused the death of Yosef by the hands of his brothers. Yaakov trusted too much in the wisdom and maturity of his sons and unwittingly fed the ego of Yosef with the special treatment that he gave him, all the while trusting in the prudence and good judgment of the brothers, assuming that they would never harm Yosef. In taking a back seat leadership-wise, Yaakov allowed Yosef to provoke his brothers and taunt them. He also enabled the brothers to take it upon themselves to determine his fate, since they perceived Yaakov as basically a lame duck leader. He was no longer an active player in the governance of the family, and it was up to them to decide what should be done with Yosef. So just as David sent Tamar to Amnon and sent Amnon to Avshalom, Yaakov sends Yosef right into the hands of his would-be murderers. One of the messages here is that it's incumbent upon a leader not to recede from the scene prematurely. As critical as it is for elders to let go and allow the younger generation to play a part in shaping their future, this can only be done gradually and when it's clear that the youth are prepared for the task. Leaders should step out of the picture when they see that the groundwork has been laid for a solid process of succession, and not simply because they are too tired, too depressed, or would prefer to enjoy a longer retirement. Such personal motives may blind them to reality and allow them to convince themselves that the people who will be taking over are more qualified for the task than is actually the case. Yaakov and David both abdicated their positions of influence too soon and caused tremendous damage as a result. Both of them were forced to endure the estrangement from and loss of the very children they believed would be their saviors and would carry the torch forward on their behalf. One final note about Tamar. In her words to Amnon, she implies that were the king to be petitioned, she and Amnon could actually have been legally wed. This is perplexing because if we take the text at face value, Tamar is Amnon's half-sister. They share a father, David, and would therefore be biblically forbidden from marrying him. The sages of the Talmud, quoted by many of the traditional commentaries, say that Ma'acha, Tamar's mother, was a captive woman that David had relations with before she converted to Judaism and then converted her and married her afterwards. And since she was conceived while her mother was still a Gentile, according to the technical halakha, she was not actually related to David or to Avshalom. Even though Avshalom and Tamar shared both a mother and a father, Avshalom was conceived and born after his mother became a Jewess and therefore has a different status. The Abarbanel rejects this interpretation as too far-fetched and argues that Tamar's claim to Amnon that they could be legally wed if they went through the right process was not really true. She was just saying that to stop him in his tracks to prevent the assault from occurring. In fact, the Abarbanel takes issue with the halachic principle itself, and that's beyond the scope of this discussion, but an interesting aside. I'd like to suggest an alternative possibility that suggested itself to me when I was studying the chapter years ago, many years ago, which is that Tamar might have been the daughter of Ma'acha from a previous husband, and therefore not blood related to Amnon or David. She would have been a biological half-brother of Avshalom because they would have shared a mother, which explains why the text refers to her several times as the sister of Avshalom, and would have been the stepdaughter of David, which would account for the fact that she's occasionally called Amnon's sister as well. If this is the case, then Amnon and Tamar could have been legally married, if David had permitted it. Although they lived in the same home and were part of the same family unit, socially speaking, they weren't related by blood. Consider the Brady Bunch as an instance of this kind of blended family, where the boys and girls grow up as brothers and sisters, but don't actually share a biological parent. This would change our reading of the story somewhat. After proposing this hypothesis, actually several years after proposing this hypothesis in the course of teaching, it came to my attention that the commentary of Tosafot in Masechet Sanhedrin offer the same explanation of the simple reading of our text. So that's a way to resolve the apparent problem of Amnon and Tamar's biological relationship.